Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG. We have an online stream, kpcg.fm as well. Coming up on today's program, there is a shortage of Dallas police officers. So if you're looking for work, maybe that's the place to look. A dangerous job. What are the most dangerous jobs in the U.S.? Got a list for you of those. And there's a new study out. Which sibling is the funniest? We've got details about what they have found. Don't know if you'll be surprised or not. And North Korea is being very much like you would expect. That and more on today's edition, Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. This is 101.3 KPCG. Live stream, kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com. You can find a link there as well. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do so, at kpcgfm. That's where you can find our tweets. And if you'd like to send us anything, emails, comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate those. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon here today as well. And interesting stories today. This first headline really jumped off the page at me. Not unexpected, I guess. They say 99 Dallas police officers have quit or retired in the last 10 weeks. So it's dangerous work. I don't know if that's the reasoning, if the violence has been the reasoning, but this seems like a high number.
Yeah, 5 sniped in July, basically, and then a lot of unrest across the country on top of that.
They say that police recruiters are trying to bring in hundreds of new police officers in Dallas, nearly 100, 99. Officers in the Dallas Police Department have quit or retired since October, according to multiple reports, and they have a deficit of personnel. I think they had a deficit before this anyway. Interim Police Chief David Pugh told city council members Monday night that the department wanted to fill the next academy class with 60 officers, but has only hired 30 for the February class. According to the Dallas Morning News, the department is down to 3,252 officers, and they would like to have at least 3,500. So they're having a hard time keeping people around, and they don't give all the details for why people would be leaving, but I would think the danger would be one of the main reasons to think twice about that occupation.
Right. A big segment of the population considering you an enemy no matter what you do. Not the most comforting position to be in.
And I was amazed that they had that many officers. I mean, Dallas is a big area. But just the fact that they have over 3,000 and they want 3,500, that kind of surprised me that they would have that many. But I guess they need it. And the cities are getting more violent, right? Chicago's record-breaking violence this year. I don't know what Dallas is doing, but any big city, you know you're going to have problems. So they need more officers, but yet it's a dangerous job. And it made me think, what are the most dangerous jobs in America? Here are the top 10. Number 1, radio host. No, kidding. That's that didn't make the list. That was number 11, maybe. They say the most dangerous job is a construction worker of some kind. And then they give the average pay is $30,890. So not a ton of money there and dangerous. Number 2 is corrections officer. I don't know if you'd consider police in that realm, but somewhat. Corrections officer, they make $40,580 a year. Emergency medical technician, dangerous job, $31,980. I was surprised at that being that low. I would think that would, you know, you're dealing with life and death. I would thought that would have paid more.
Right. They probably perform the more basic, immediate procedures out wherever they picked up the person, and then they take them back to the hospital for the more advanced procedures. So maybe that's why they're paid a little bit less. But it is such a crucial job.
Yeah. I mean, you'd think every day come. I know jobs get sort of routine, mm-hmm. but that one, I don't know how that would be routine. You know, you're dealing with all sorts of emergencies. And there was a couple months ago, I was in Edmond, locally here, and there was a car accident. and so the EMT were there assisting. And the thing that I noticed was that both of the EMT workers were so out of shape. I was afraid for their safety. I thought, how are they going to? I mean, it was way over the top in terms of fitness level. They did not have fitness level. And I thought, wow, how can you perform your job with this low level of fitness? So, but they did.
Maybe they're not held up to quite the standards that they should be.
Well, it is interesting. Sometimes you see that. I've been in hospitals occasionally, and thankfully not for my own personal health, but for visiting or something. And I've seen doctors smoking outside, and you think like, well, come on. I mean, you know better than that. But
they've seen patients come in with lung cancer.
Yeah,
and yet they keep smoking.
Yeah, it's addictive.
Yeah.
Another dangerous job is a farmer. They make a little more apparently, $64,170. So that's a little better. But yeah, there's a lot of dangers in farm work. I grew up in a farming community. I can remember several instances where local people dying, just an accident or something, happens. Firefighter, of course, dangerous job, $46,870. Nursing assistant, that's a little surprising to me that that's dangerous, but I guess you're dealing with illness. $25,710. I'm assuming that's why it's dangerous. I don't know why else it would be. Here we go. Police officer. That is a separate category here. Police officers on the list as well. $60,270. It's not a bad payday. Taxi driver. Dangerous. $23,510. That's not very much. Truck driver. $40,260. And finally, veterinarian. $88,490. I suppose you get bit by an animal or something.
Well, that salary sounds worth it, though.
Yeah. You would think that the more dangerous, the more you should get paid.
Yeah.
And it's not always the case. Sometimes it is.
Yeah. Well, the corrections officer is making about $40,000, and he's dealing with crazed inmates all the time. That would be just a nightmare job.
Yeah, it would be. That would be a very difficult job. So those are the 10 most dangerous jobs in the U.S. as far as overall career fields. I'm sure there are some individualized jobs that not a lot of people do that are dangerous as well. You have people that work high steel construction, and that's probably factored into the construction, but they got to walk around up there on those.
Yeah. My father used to paint those big, huge water towers that you see in most towns.
Yeah.
And I believe he said sometimes he'd just go up without a harness. He just had no fear of heights.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
He wasn't putting graffiti on him, was he?
I don't think so. He's painting like City of Edmond, basically. That's
right.
About it.
You always see where somebody goes up and they paint like,
How do you get away with that?
Yeah, I don't know.
What a creative criminal.
I see that when I drive sometimes under an overpass and you see all the graffiti. Mm-hmm. And I think, what time of day do you do that? 2 in the morning? Because there's cars. How do you, do they kind of hang over the edge?
Bungee cords?
I don't know.
Hang upside down while they paint?
I don't know. It's strange that people do that. But, fear of heights, that would be, if you don't have a fear of heights. Sometimes I think people get so accustomed to it, they don't use the harnesses because it slows them down. I've talked to some people that have done some pretty difficult painting as well. Mm-hmm. And said the same thing, day one or two you use the harness, but then you just want to move freely and you just stop doing it. So
yeah, just be careful of your step and you can go a little bit faster that way.
We're not using harnesses right now.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
Hey, we're on the second story. Anything could happen. You never know.
We could fall straight through.
You could fall straight through. A lot of times people wonder about siblings in a family and what order you are and what that means about you. And of course, it's not an exact science, but there's some trends, I guess. They say there's now definite proof that the youngest siblings are the funniest in the family. You're the oldest. So what does that say about you?
Well, I knew Micah was the funniest in our family anyway. I'm close, though. I would say that. The girls aren't even close at all.
Oh, okay.
The two middle girls.
The comments on the story said that the middle kids were left out like always because the study doesn't deal with them. It deals with the oldest and the youngest. We don't care about the ones in the middle. They say, as it turns out, being the youngest in your family officially makes you funnier. I don't know how that's official, but that is according to a YouGov study, which found that firstborn siblings feel the weight of responsibility greater than their youngest brothers and sisters, who tend to be more easygoing, relaxed, and humorous. So you being the oldest, you have to bear the brunt, the weight of the great responsibility in your family, and your younger brother can just laugh it all the way around.
Probably most people who know me don't see me as too heavily burdened, though.
No,
so
I don't.
I hide
so.
It pretty well, at least.
And again, it's a trend, so it's not, you know, it's not everybody. They say, to be exact, 36% of firstborns said they felt like the funniest. So I don't know if they're going on who what you feel like. I don't know that that's an accurate study. Compared to 46% of lastborns, a group which also felt like they are more likely to be favored by their parents. Favor the youngest. What do you think? Is that true?
Well, I know that there's a lot of jokes about how parents will be a little bit more lax as they go on. Like, with the firstborn, every little obstacle in the child's life could be life-threatening. But then when you see a youngest born chewing on a cigarette butt, you say it's more fiber. So it's kind of like, in that way, maybe they're less worried about the potential safety concerns. And also, they're less stubborn. I think the younger kids are less stubborn, so... I received more correction than the other three combined, I would say.
That's why you're not so funny. You had to deal with all the punishment. I think that's probably true. The firstborn, it's new for everybody. It's new for the parents. It's new for the child. And then the last one, you've been there and done that, and It is maybe a little more relaxed. And then as a younger sibling, you have to deal with your older siblings too, in addition to the parents. So there's kind of several layers of things you have to deal with.
Yeah, well, definitely I'm – like the enforcer in Micah's life. So if he's being sneaky or passively rebellious, I can catch him sometimes when maybe my parents don't even notice.
No.
So I put him in line pretty fast.
And it's developed a great sense of humor there. They say this study was based on nearly 1,800 British adult siblings who rated their personality traits along with their sisters and brothers. So again, I don't know how scientific that is, but it's a trend maybe. You do hear that sometimes. I guess thinking about different people, I would think that's kind of the case. I'm the youngest in my family, and
you're hilarious.
Some people consider me to be funny, so I don't know. There might be something to it. So that's the report anyway. So because it kind of looks favorably upon me, I'm going to accept it as fact. But don't look up anything bad about the youngest.
Well, it's also true in my dad's family and in my mom's family. My mom is the oldest, and my uncle Stephen, Mr. Stephen Fleury, is the youngest, and he is comical much of the time. And then my dad's youngest brother, he has scared me several times. Like one time, I walked down the stairs, and he was staying in our house, and he had this ogre mask on, just scared me half to death.
As a joke, I
assume? As a joke, okay. But I mean, I can't imagine any of his other siblings doing that. And then another time he offered me a piece of gum, and I tried to pull it out of the package, and it zapped my hand. So I guess it was a prank.
Oh, brother. Yeah, that is funny. So anyway, you can think about that for your own personal families and whether or not that's true. Do a little research. Ask your kids and your brothers and sisters who's the funniest. And you can all take a vote on it and see if it's see if you agree or disagree. This one's kind of interesting story. Wake Forest, the college over there, radio announcer fired after school concludes he gave opponents information. Sometimes there's spying and there's other things that happen. And, you know, with the Patriots, there was that Spygate thing. Well, this is college football. They say Wake Forest said it was investigating a game plan breach after a loss to Louisville. Could have been that Louisville is better than them, too, but nevertheless. They say Wake Forest radio announcer Tommy Elrod, this should say former announcer because they fired him, has been fired after the school said an investigation found he had been giving Wake Forest opponents information about the Demon Deacons since 2014. I assume that information was more than just, hey, we're not that good. That was a breach in the game plan. Wake Forest coach Dave Clawson said after a November 12th loss to Louisville that there was a game plan breach the school was investigating. After the game, Wake Forest football staff discovered materials left behind by Louisville that showed the Cardinals were prepared for plays the Demon Deacons had not run before. So they knew the plays were coming. Hand it off and run right up the middle. Haven't seen that one before. Wake Forest led the Cardinals 12-0 before giving up 44 straight points.
Oh.
I don't think those four plays factored into that. But anyway, Louisville coach Bobby Petrino said after Clawson's remarks that he had no knowledge of the situation, but they fired him anyway. So that's kind of the first time that I can remember hearing about somebody working for this for a school or a team, like as a radio personality, giving info to other teams. He must have been getting paid or something if he did that.
Yeah, that would be pretty hard to prove. But I've always wondered, even just from watching a game, you know how at the beginning of an NFL game they'll say, you know, earlier this week I was talking to the quarterback and he said they plan to run a lot of triple option plays this week. They haven't done it all year, but they're going to break it out and try to surprise the other team. What if someone who is affiliated with the other team is watching the broadcast and can somehow relay it down to the field where the other team is, and they'll be ready for that trick play that they shouldn't have even known was coming?
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess they got to try to keep all their plans secret as much as possible.
Yeah, it would be pretty easy to spill some secrets unintentionally on the broadcast because you're supposed to give the viewers insight. So,
right.
I mean, that's why you're talking to the players throughout the week so you can kind of give people the inside scoop. But what if someone's watching and they can pass it on?
Yeah, well, this guy has lost his job, so I don't know if he'll be able to say petition that and go back and try to prove otherwise. But yeah, I can't think of any reason you'd even want to do that unless teams were paying you to do it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's hard to say. Anything could happen. There's a lot of shady stuff, but you get in a lot of trouble for something like that. You lose your job like this guy did. So I don't know if it's worth it. Maybe they weren't paying him enough.
Yeah.
Wake Forest needs to up their pay.
Yeah, there has to be something to that because if you're traveling with the team all the time and you know them all on a personal level, it seems pretty unlikely as a radio broadcaster that you would try to betray that same team. So maybe there was something else going on there.
Yeah. I know when I was in high school, our football team, which I was not part of, never won a game in my entire four-year high school career and then shortly after I left the school, they switched divisions. We were kind of playing above our, we were punching above our weight, as they say, and we did okay in some sports, but when it came to football, just didn't have the size, and we lost every game, so I don't think we could blame it on someone giving away the game plan, other than the fact that we were smaller and weaker and slower than the other team.
Right.
I think they knew that.
Yeah, well, as a team, you can't really blame a radio announcer for failing. I mean, if you execute plays well enough, it doesn't matter if the other team knows it's coming.
Well, that's
still beat
yeah.
them.
And that's a good point in and of itself. I mean, it's very rarely are you just like completely, you know, fooled. Wow, we've never seen this before. It's just a matter of can you stop it?
Right.
I mean, it's not like people don't know that, you know, Steph Curry's going to shoot threes. But you got to stop it. And that because you can't stop it all the time or very often, that's why he makes a lot of money and he's good. Right.
Yeah.
No one's confused by what's happening out there. It's just he shoots it from really far away.
Right.
And it goes in.
Basically, you can either shoot a three or a layup. And very rarely anymore do you see a jumper. Same with football. You can either throw it or pass it. It's not too complex.
You just have to be able to stop it. But anyway, the fellow lost his job. If you've flown and been on a very long flight, you know that that's not fun, typically. Qantas prepares to fly world's longest route in 2018, so they've got the longest one now. The Qantas announcement of a new flight from Perth, Australia to London won't just be the world's longest, but it's also making aviation history. It will be the first time ever that a regularly scheduled nonstop flight will exist between the two continents. So it's kind of nice to have a nonstop, but at the same time, it is nice to get out and stretch your legs and just regain your senses after being on the flight for so long. It's going to be a long flight. They say it's going to be a Dreamliner 7879 that will be used for the route. Australians have never had a direct link to Europe before, so the opportunities this opens up are huge, according to the Qantas CEO. And the new flight is going to total 17 hours without stopping, a trip totaling over 9,000 miles.
Wow.
So it's amazing you can go that far that fast.
Exactly. And it seems like if you're going to be in a plane for about a day, you should be able to just live your life as if you're not even on a plane. I don't know if you've seen pictures of some luxury planes, but they've got like a blackjack table and a pool table and all this stuff. How is that possible if you're supposed to be buckled in the whole time? So how are you able to play all these games and enjoy that if you have to be buckled in?
Getting rid of the harness.
Yeah.
Get out of the harness. No, if you're on a flight that long, if you can just move. I mean, you don't want much, but you just want to be able to stretch out your legs, maybe kind of lay down, and be able to stand up comfortably. I mean, that's it. If you can do those things, I think it would be great. But when you get jammed into that little seat, and then you start thinking, I got to be here for 17 hours. Then you're like, I got to calm down.
Panic attack coming
on. Start sweating. Yeah. And I got to relax. So this is a long one. They say, where does it put it in terms of the world's longest? It's all relative. Some flights last a little longer, but this is the longest as far as mileage. So 9,000 miles.
That's incredible.
Nonstop.
Yeah. That's got to be a huge fuel tank, too, for those planes.
Yeah. So it's neat that you can go that far, but hopefully people don't have to do it too often because it takes a toll. I was surprised flight attendant wasn't one of the more dangerous jobs. That seems like that would be a dangerous job just from your health in terms of all the up and down and, of course, dealing with rowdy passengers.
And there's always the off chance that you crash in the ocean.
There is a chance of that, yes. Yeah. There was a video the other day on one of the nightly news shows of some lady, one of the flights, I don't know where it was, here in the U.S., I think, and she had to get dragged off the plane because she just ran through all the security points and ran onto the flight. I don't know how they couldn't stop her, but she got on there, and then they showed somebody took cell phone video, and they're dragging her off, an officer pulling each arm, and she's just laying there limp and getting dragged off the plane. And I thought, I wonder if they told her, like, you lay here, and we're going to pull you off, or if she refused to go. I would imagine she refused.
Probably refused.
And so they just dragged her out of there like a fish.
And they probably didn't try too hard to stop her because she's going onto a plane. How does she escape once she's on the plane? It's a dead end at that point. And they can just follow her on casually and get her out.
Do you run full speed, through all the gate checks, get on there, and then try to sit down and act like nothing happened? Oh, me? What, you're me?
Lock yourself in the bathroom, maybe? Yeah. I don't know.
Or just pretend you're sleeping, and they're like, ma'am, and you're, no, I'm sleeping. Yeah, so I don't know the story there, but they pulled her off the flight. That's interesting. This next headline here, I really have nothing to say about it. I just think it's funny. 168 cases of monkey bread mix recalled due to salmonella risk. Just the fact that there's something called monkey bread mix made me laugh.
I hope that's not made out of actual monkeys.
No.
Please tell me it's not.
It looks like the package looked like some sort of a cake, kind of like a hole in the middle. And I don't know. Monkey. I've never heard of monkey bread. Have you?
No. That's disturbing almost.
Just the fact that, you know, you'd buy monkey bread and then they're like, this could kill you. I'd think, yeah, I would think so. It's monkey bread.
Exactly.
Shouldn't it be called human bread?
Aren't most monkeys crawling with salmonella? So
I don't know.
It's accurate.
Maybe that's the second part of the headline, but safe for monkeys. Humans don't eat it, but it'd be like calling a banana like a monkey banana. It's not a monkey. It's a human banana.
Yeah.
It's a banana. I don't know. It's just a funny headline. I've never heard of monkey bread. I'm sure there are people out there that are like, I eat monkey bread all the time. You don't know what you're talking about. And I apologize to those people, but I just never heard of it.
It's probably commonplace in somewhere like Australia.
I can't imagine going through the aisle, you know, and being like, monkey bread, and buying it.
Yeah, it's strange.
Unless I had a pet monkey, then I probably would. I think we talked about this a while ago, Grant. This is a Reddit from CNN.com. I think you brought this term into the realm of my consciousness. Fubbing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's a combination of snubbing and phone, like fubbing. Mm-hmm. You ignore somebody because you're on your smartphone. They say, is fubbing ruining your relationship? Yes, it is.
Wow.
For many people. They say the majority of our relationships are in shambles. Wow. The U.S. divorce rate hovers at 40%, but that's not the whole story, they say. Many intact relationships are on life support. According to a survey by the National Opinion Research Center, 60% of people in a relationship say they're not very satisfied. Well, that would be lame. Get that report in the mail. By the way, your wife's not satisfied in your relationship.
Ouch.
Well, yeah. Not that they would tell their partner, I suppose. They say there are some familiar culprits, money problems, etc., but there's a new one. It's the smartphone causing problems with families and marriages.
It can be easy to imagine how that would happen. I mean, sometimes if you're looking at a screen, you tend to zone out everything else. And so there have been a couple of times where my wife has come up to me and said something, and I don't even hear a thing if I'm on the computer.
We can only kind of direct our attention in one area at a time.
Yeah.
As much as we try to multitask, typically we can only do one thing. This author here says, my colleague Meredith David and I recently conducted a study that explored just how detrimental smartphones can be to relationships. She says, we zeroed in on measuring something called fubbing, a fusion of phone and snubbing. I just wish there was a better word for that. It just sounds weird to me.
It does.
It sounds like monkey bread. It's how often they say your romantic partner is distracted by his or her smartphone in your presence. With more and more people using the attention siphoning devices, the typical American checks his or her smartphone once every 6.5 minutes, or roughly 150 times each day. Yeah. Grant, are you listening? Or are you on your smartphone? Pay attention to me. I'm talking
to you. The
reason
for the silence there. I was checking my phone.
Yeah. What's that now? They say this fubbing has emerged as a real source of conflict. In one study, 70% of participants said that fubbing hurt their ability to interact with their romantic partners.
That's terrible. Yeah. It's easy to see how that can happen, though. I mean, you go home from work and you're a little bit tired and you just zone out. You don't have much energy to read a book, but you can't really fall asleep yet either. So what do people turn to? And I think it would also be shocking to find out, checking the phone 150 times a day, how many hours does that add up to? Probably several.
Yeah, it probably does, because, you know, you'd be on there various amounts of time. And then even if you don't necessarily want to check your phone, it always asks to be checked with dings and whistles. And we just got, my wife and I just got new phones, and it makes noises, and we don't even know. We're like, what is that even doing? What is it telling us? Random,
right.
Random noises. It's like a little kid or something. Like, hey guys, look at me over here. I have something to tell you. You know,
and they're really hard to silence too. I mean, it's, you have to go through the applications one by one and silence the notifications that way.
Yeah, and then if you just, you know, put your phone on vibrate or something, then yeah, I end up missing what I needed to see. I'm like, I didn't even see that. So it's a conundrum. There are different ways to deal with it, I guess. Some people say they put their phones away at a certain time, mm-hmm. or things like that. But anyway, there's different ways to deal with it. But it is a problem for some people.
Leave it out of the bedroom. That's another good one.
Yep. But I use it for my alarm. Wakes
That's
me
tough.
Up.
Yeah. I have the old school alarm clock.
Mm-hmm. Like just the clock radio type, or is mm-hmm. it's not okay. I had a vision of like the real old one that actually
with the two bells
on
top. It's
like the bell. Yeah, you got to hit it. So of course this next story happened. North Korea. Only in North Korea. This is a headline. I'm not making this up. Drunken Kim Jong-un forces top military leaders to write apology letters, and then he forgets that he did it. What a strange, strange man.
Why would a god on earth need to drink alcohol yeah. to excess?
That's what they think he is, I guess. It says, Kim Jong-un is not a happy drunk. The ruthless North Korean dictator or he's not happy when he's sober either, you could add. The ruthless North Korean dictator overindulged on spirits this September when he ordered several top military vets to write apology and self-criticism letters. Can you imagine somebody telling you that? Go ahead and you write me a letter where you apologize and criticize yourself and hand that in.
It's a bit humiliating, isn't it?
It is a bit humiliating.
They're just blessed to not have been ordered to be killed, because I believe he's done things like that as well.
Yeah, and that factors into this story as well. And this is the reason, apparently, that he made them write the letters. He says that none of you were able to produce not even one military satellite is a misconduct that is commensurate to treason. So that's tough. If you have a job and they're like, you know what, go ahead and get one of those, satellites or rockets or whatever they're doing, satellite, I guess, up in space. And if you don't, that's treason.
Oh.
Like, I don't know how to do it, though. So
I don't know how to do
it.
You don't know how to do it. Most everyone on Earth doesn't know how to do it.
I guess you just tell him you did it and hope that he doesn't check. So anyway, that's why he told these top military people during this all-night reprimand to write these letters. But the next morning, the tyrant was no longer inebriated and asked why the elderly officials were at his villa. He didn't remember what happened. He's like, what are you guys doing here? And he said to them, why are you gathered here? Be careful about your health, because you are all old. Thanks for the reminder.
Old and worthless and in need of writing apology letters.
Wow. So they say, with that, the military men began crying, a reaction which pleased Kim, according to the account. It says they were relieved because they thought they were going to be purged or killed, of course. Everyone is showing loyalty out of fear of being executed, and no one dares speak against Kim. So in some ways, it's not really funny, but it's just the ridiculousness of what goes on over there. But it's interesting, too, because you do have people in the United States, there are some that talk about the U.S. being such a horrible place and so forth. Well, do you want to go over here and hang out with Kim Jong-un for a while? I don't.
And this account is from 3 months ago, so it kind of shows you how reclusive and closed off North Korea is. We're only just now finding out about this.
Yeah, it's and who knows what we don't know, right? The stuff that he's involved in. Having to be under the rule of somebody like that is crazy. That's what happens when it becomes, people looking to just one dictatorial-type ruler in different systems that man has. You get guys like this. You get families like this, and they just rule with an iron fist. And you have to write criticism and self-apology letters. Sounds like something I would not want to have to do. That would be not fun. This is Trumpet Radio Live. You're listening to today here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. Email us any comments you have, comments@kpcg.fm. We appreciate those. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau stopping by again today. How you doing, Abraham?
Doing pretty well.
Great. The Kia David program is coming up here in a bit on KPCG, and also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Richard Palmer today, filling in for Stephen Fleury. And so make sure you listen for that, and you can check the archives at kpcg.fm if you can't catch it live, or if you missed part of it and you just want to catch up or listen again, you can do that. kpcg.fm, and thetrumpet.com has archives also. Abraham, you have a poll that you have conducted at your Twitter account, at Abraham Blondeau. The most famous horse in history.
Yes.
This is a bit obscure, and you've got a few choices here. What are the choices, and what are the results?
Yeah, so I was just reading a book, and they were talking about horses in history, and like, wow, that sounds like a good poll.
Was the book actually on horses in history, or was it like a side note?
No, it was just a side note. The book's called What If, and it goes through different counterfactual events.
Oh, because I know you love history, but if you're to the point now, if you've read everything to now where you have to go into the history of horses, you need to get help.
Oh, I don't like equine that much. There are four choices. The first one is Bucephalus, who was Alexander the Great's horse. He's the one who his father Philip had bought for a high price because no one could break the horse.
Right.
But Alexander could.
What's the name?
Bucephalus.
Sounds like a disease.
It does.
It's actually, I think it's a cool name, Bucephalus.
Sounds
I forget what it means.
Sounds like monkey bread.
Yeah. Maybe that's why they named the horse that. The second one is Copenhagen, which was the Duke of Wellington's horse. It's the one he rode at the Battle of Waterloo. And there's a funny story about this one. One of his Wellington's friends said, he's never seen a horse like Copenhagen, and he referred to the scripture in Job where God writes about the horse, and the horse says, ha and ha, amongst the trumpets of battle. And Copenhagen would actually do that. During a battle, he would rear up and just be really loud and stuff like that.
That was like a dramatic reading you just did there.
Thank you. Yeah.
Ha and ha.
I'm working on the sweater first, now I'm trying to work on my charisma.
Isn't Copenhagen like a type of chewing tobacco?
It's the capital of Denmark.
There's all kinds of Copenhagen. Yeah. That's the first thing I thought of was chewing tobacco.
Right.
I don't know why. I guess I just saw the ad for it or something. Yeah, okay.
The third one is Traveler, which was the name of General Lee's horse during the Civil War. And the fourth one is Big Red. That was General Patton's horse. And this was his favorite horse. It's the one that was at his funeral. It was a riderless horse they had go through as part of his funeral.
I probably would vote for Big Red because I just like the name. I was hoping there'd be like, all these epic names and then like peaches.
Right.
Do you also like the Big Red gum?
Yeah, I do like that. It is.
It's pretty spicy though.
It is spicy. what did people vote on? What are they like?
So the number one was Bucephalus, Alexander's horse. And that one, it is pretty famous. In fact, I think Jeremiah Jacques talks about him in one of his Sun Also Rises episodes.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was Traveler, General Lee's, and he's probably the most famous American horse, I would say. Big Red was third, 19%, and Copenhagen came in last. So no one likes Copenhagen.
Yeah, interesting.
So they're voting on the horse itself or just the name of the horse?
I have no idea. Everyone can interpret this as they want. I think the point of the poll is which one have you heard of, like which one's the most famous. But people could be voting for who, the owner or the name, or I have no idea.
This will probably make me sound kind of uninformed. But if you ask me, you like, quick, top of your head, famous horses, I'd be like, Trigger Mr. Ed.
Right.
The one Paul Revere rode.
Yeah, that
whatever
one.
That's called.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, you know, those are the two horses that I know. Trigger, Roy Rogers, I believe, the famous horse. He'd always just make the noise and it would run, and then he'd jump off of a saloon and right. land on him and ride away.
I almost said Old Yeller, but I think that's a dog.
It is.
Yeah, that's a golden retriever. Yeah.
Famous. That'll be your next one. Famous yeah. dogs in history. Old Yeller.
What was the name of the Lone Ranger?
Oh.
His horse.
Was that not Trigger?
No, Trigger was Roy Rogers, right?
Yeah. I thought it was something to do with like a silver.
Yeah, hi-ho silver. Away, yeah. That's what he always said.
Yeah, hi-ho silver.
So maybe his name was Silver.
Yeah, that's his
name. Or maybe his name was hi-ho silver.
Yeah.
And it just kind of worked out.
Hi-ho. Ho is his middle name, I guess. Yeah.
He was greeting him, but the horse always ran away. Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, that was, I just wanted to, I just thought it was interesting to see. And actually, I got more response to that one than some of my more, like normal history polls.
That's
so
always
that's interesting.
That's always the way it is. If you put up something like a poll or anything on Twitter, you know, if you want to get a lot of likes, it has to be sort of out there a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of, and just more like, I don't know, interesting but not hard hitting. It seems to be the way it goes.
Cat related. Yeah.
Cat related.
Something relatively shallow, not too deep.
Famous cats that rode horses.
That's true. Yeah, well, I'll have to do a lot more research if I want to do that one.
Digging deep there.
I did have another poll earlier this year. I asked what was the most surprising moment of 2016. I had Brexit, Donald Trump being elected, my brother getting married, or me getting married.
Uh-huh.
And I came in second place. Donald Trump won, but I was a close second.
Wow. So that would make you, on Time Magazine, that make you the second person of the year, like
yes.
right below him.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, it was you. It was him, you, and then Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
Yeah. you've got a write-up for us here from foreignpolicy.com. Merkel and whose army question, that's the title, says a German military that practices with broomsticks, makes me think of witches, isn't in a position to become the new leader of the free world. So they've got some unique training methods, and they got to up their military game a little bit, it sounds like.
That's right. Yeah, this is a really interesting article because it kind of shows that Angela Merkel is a paper tiger. That means that she shows a lot of strength, maybe moral strength, but Germany isn't actually that strong militarily, and that's their big weakness, especially with many people saying that they should be the new leader of the free world with Donald Trump being elected. But as this author points out, they're actually not that qualified because of their weakness militarily.
Right, and that's do they go much into their capabilities? So, I mean, they haven't had to have much of a military with the U.S. and NATO for what the last well since World War II, so quite a while. But they obviously are an industrial power; they can make things well and quickly, and so. Obviously, they have the ability to ramp up very fast. I mean, historically, after World War One, same sort of thing. Not much of a military. And then Hitler got them really, they just dumped the resources in. All of a sudden, they have this power. So you can do it and do it quickly if history is any indication.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, Germany is very powerful, but there are many factors holding it back. The big one is NATO and the presence of the U.S., it would be hard for a leader to get the people of Germany to support
right.
an army as long as the U.S. is there.
And both of which are waning.
Yes.
U.S. and NATO.
Yep.
So, yeah.
And the other factor is just their culture, the anti-war culture that has been there since World War II. It is difficult to break that. And we have seen that starting to loosen up, but not to the point where their military has expanded significantly, at least in terms of numbers. And they have some great statistics here. So if today the U.S. stopped being the world policeman and Germany tried to step into that role, here are some comparative numbers to show you where Germany stands right now. So the U.S. defense budget in 2015 was $597.5 billion. Germany's was $36.7 billion.
Yeah.
So obviously, U.S. has a bigger budget than all the rest of the nations combined, I believe. But still, if a nation only has a $36.7 billion budget, which is less than 2% of their GDP, they're not a nation that can project that power around the world. They have some other numbers here. So during the Cold War, the Federal Republic of Western Germany, they had about 500,000 men and 2,500 Leopard 2 battle tanks. So during the Cold War, Western Germany had that power. Today, Germany has about 176,000 active military personnel, which is the U.S. has 1.3 million. Germany has just about 200 Leopard 2 battle tanks. So since the Cold War, that has decreased significantly because there isn't a threat, a perceived threat right now. Even as this article points out, even with Russia on the march and other situations, he's writing from Germany, I believe. There isn't really a lot of motivation from the German people. There isn't a lot of urgency. He said there's more urgency in the migrant crisis for there to be more stable, like police rule at home, than there is for a military force. So there has to be some kind of shock or crisis if the German military is to expand really significantly.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at it, I guess, a couple of ways. You could say, well, as this article says, hey, they're not quite ready. But on the other hand, you could see potential. They're not putting too much of their GDP into it right now. If you change that, of course, all of a sudden things change. And also, because they don't have a lot of military equipment, everything gets to be brand new.
Right.
You know, they're not maintaining a aging fleet, of ships or a bunch of tanks and so forth, which the U.S., I don't know how much new development we have versus just sustaining what we already have produced. But, you know, we have a lot of reports about things that the U.S. is doing and they don't work or, you know, it costs more than they thought. I mean, here you'd get to build something from the ground up, latest technology, latest ways of doing it. Potential is pretty awesome.
Yeah, and that's, I think, what most people miss is that there are still a lot of obstacles to Germany becoming a military power again. However, all the foundational blocks are still there. And the main key to German success in the World Wars was the officer corps. That's why Hitler could build a military machine, because the officers were already trained. If he did not have the officer corps, he could have had the equipment and the manpower, but they wouldn't have been as well led. So that's the German army as a corps. That's the most important thing, and they still have that core leadership there. So that's the most important building block. And as you mentioned, it doesn't take much to imagine Germany's industrial capacity switching to a wartime footing or to producing military technology, because they are a world leader in military technology as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting. There's a really good Key of David program on Germany's plan to destroy Iran, and there's maps there, and it shows how they are encircling Iran. They are encircling the Middle East with small pockets of military, but it wouldn't take much to make that 100 into 10,000, and all of a sudden you've got this huge ring. Like, it's in place, and probably they're getting great training. And you just have to dump in the resources, and all of a sudden, you know, it's like the chia pet. Pour water on it, and you got a huge thing sitting there all of a sudden.
Right.
What a great analogy, right? Yeah.
Incredible.
Well, that's the thing about modern warfare, is the rules have changed. You don't need a huge army to be successful anymore, because technology does make up that difference. And especially if you look at the prophecies about that Herbert Armstrong talked about, that Gerald Flory talks about a resurgent militant Germany. It's in the context of Germany being allied with 9 other nations. So it's not just the German army. When you combine together the population of Europe, they can actually have a pretty sizable army, especially taking in France and the sizable countries. So that's a part of it where Germany doesn't have to make up the manpower. The other is the technology. In the age of weapons of mass destruction, you don't need a lot of troops to cause a lot of damage. And if you can tactically use nuclear weapons or other high-powered explosives, you can negate your disadvantage in numbers very quickly, especially if you strike first and unexpectedly.
Which is what they historically do,
yep.
Blitzkrieg. So obviously the big piece of the puzzle there is the leadership, Angela Merkel.
Exactly.
You get a leader that's ready to go and get serious about the military like a Hitler was. It didn't take him too long to really get things going there. And so that's what we can expect to look for. Some leader that's more of that mindset.
Yeah, because at the beginning of the article, he says people, the German people call her a mommy or a mother. And that's not a figure that's going to inspire a lot of loyalty or inspiration in the troops.
Mother general?
Yeah.
General mother.
At the end of the article, he has this story of Joseph Stalin. Someone was talking to Stalin about how powerful the Pope is. And all Stalin said was, how many divisions has he got? And that's true. And that's the thing a lot of nations forget in the world context is you need hard power. You do need an army. And as the U.S. Army starts to recede, that harsh reality is coming back where instead of nations concentrating on soft power, we're going to see nations starting to get more divisions because they're going to need them.
Yeah, I mean, that's true anywhere you look. Even we were talking earlier about Dallas having a shortage of police officers. And so there's problems in cities. So what do you need? Hard power. You need more police officers.
Yeah.
They know that, even though they don't necessarily... go all out like a military force would. But yeah, you can't go into a crime situation or especially another country trying to fight you and, come to them with some sort of, I don't know, anything but. You have to have hard power to deal with that force. So really interesting to see how this is taking shape. And Abraham, you're also on the Trumpet Hour today.
Yes.
You're all over the map.
He was just on Just the Best Literature as well.
Yeah, that's recently. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all over.
How much are you getting paid, by the way? No, I'm just kidding.
actually, I don't know.
That's a great question.
Doesn't even know.
I don't even really work here.
It's doing all this stuff for free.
That's what makes it so astounding. How
are you getting so much time off from your regular jobs?
So he does all the top 10 most dangerous jobs in America, and he's on about 4 programs.
And I do obscure Twitter polls on horses.
A man for all seasons, as it were. Grant, you've got a write-up here. This is always a hot-button issue. This is from LifeZet. Kasich fails conservatives on heartbeat bill, and this has to do with abortion, which is always a big issue here in the U.S. So what's the situation with this bill, and what are they saying about it?
Well, this is the Ohio governor, John Kasich, and on Tuesday, he signed a bill into law that, in a way, this is a good thing, at least bans abortions after 20 weeks. As long as those abortions wouldn't even save the life of a mother, or if these abortions didn't involve rape or incest. So they're saying after 20 weeks, if it isn't a life-saving procedure, or if it is a life-saving procedure for the mother, you can still abort the child. Or if it's rape or incest, you can. But otherwise, 20 weeks is the cutoff point. It used to be 24 weeks in Ohio, so... It's a slight improvement, I guess you could say. But at the same time, he used veto power to strike down this bill called the heartbeat bill. This would have prohibited abortions once a fetal heartbeat is detected, which is actually way back around 6 weeks. So he's basically, it seems like, taking a God prerogative, saying the cutoff is at 20 weeks, and also you can't do it as early as 6 weeks.
Yeah, that really is amazing that man in general would think to make laws like that. Like, I'll decide when life is life.
Yeah.
And, it was very interesting, though, with the heartbeat even, because I know for one of my children, we didn't hear the heartbeat for quite a while. And we'd go in, and you were supposed to, and we didn't. And mm-hmm. So we weren't sure, but it turns out that he was hiding. he didn't want to be seen, I guess. But it was there, and we did hear it. But even in going something like that, like say that was your exact thing. Now, I know they would do it by time, mm-hmm. but even if you're looking for that, sometimes you don't hear it, and it's the child's still there and fine and everything. But, of course, we wanted to have the child. In some cases, people don't feel the same.
Right. That's the tough part about this is that, obviously, a lot of people who are even considering an abortion, the furthest thing from their minds is ever having a child. So that's kind of why this is so controversial. 20 weeks is the cutoff point. Where you can't have abortions past that except for extenuating circumstances. But if it's 6 weeks and there's a heartbeat, he's still fine with it being aborted then. So
he's probably made everybody upset, both sides of the argument here.
Right. That's what this article says, is he's basically infuriated those who are pro-life and not done enough to satisfy those who are pro-choice. So what was the point of all this?
Where does he come down personally? Is he consider himself pro-life or pro-choice? Or?
Well, he is a Republican, so it's pretty likely he's pro-life, at least for the most part. He's trying to say that some of these rulings would be unconstitutional if he blocked women from choosing and things like that, and that it'd be a waste of taxpayer dollars to sign a controversial conservative law in the state of Ohio that would then possibly be overturned as unconstitutional anyway if you sign the heartbeat bill.
Well, it's interesting to bring up the Constitution at all, because the whole idea of abortion is there's some question about the constitutionality of that at all, right? If I'm remembering my history correctly, like, you know, they can look at, I guess, general principles in the Constitution and try to come up, you know, with something and say, well, it, you know, we assume that the Constitution would allow for this, but we've seen all kinds of things that that's kind of a stretch, I think, to say the least.
Well, yeah, we're supposed to have the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but now we're taking the God prerogative to say that doesn't apply to infants in the womb.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the constitutional history with abortion, it's one of the most controversial cases in U.S. history, because the way that the majority opinion who signed an abortion as constitutional law, they use an argument saying that abortion is part of someone's privacy. And originally stemmed from a battle over contraceptives with Planned Parenthood and everything. But they use the idea that what happens between the man and the woman, what happens, whatever, like in the concept of a, or in the context of a child being conceived, that's a private matter, and therefore the state cannot intervene to stop an abortion, because that is in that realm of privacy. So that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because it doesn't. If you read the majority paper, I forget who penned it, which justice penned it, but it's with a bunch of sentences that don't even make sense. It's just a very confusing moment in Supreme Court history. But even that, a lot of people are really confused by it. And I think Newt Gingrich was really excited, because he was hoping to strike down that law if they can get the Supreme Court justices on the side. But if a conservative governor won't even stand up for pro-life, it's very unlikely that that's ever going to happen.
It would be there would be a lot of protests against it, that's for sure. It'd be interesting to see if it came down to just a popular vote, because it seems like in some situations, things that have been passed as law, and if you were to listen to the media, you would think most people are behind it. I think when it comes to the popular vote, they're not, actually. With a lot of the more controversial things that come up, so yeah, this is always a interesting topic. You know, I did some research into abortion a while ago, just for something I was working on, and you know, people will, like, they bring up the situations that you mentioned, rape, incest, some of those horrible things. The percentage of people that have that happen and then have an abortion, it's minuscule, tiny.
Really, it's a distracting argument to make another excuse for why an abortion is okay.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, like the old saying, two wrongs don't make a right. I mean, it's not like a bad situation like that, obviously, is horrible. Adding on to it is horrible. I mean, it's all bad, right? But a lot of times that argument is brought up. Well, what about the case of, you know, those examples you mentioned? But you look at the numbers, and very few people have those situations happen. I mean, it is tiny. I forget the percentage points, but it was,
oh yeah,
I mean, it was, I think it was less than 1%, or it was right around. I mean, it's very, very low.
Exactly. It really is just a distraction, and people need to have different reasons to think that an abortion could be moral in some cases. There are also a couple other pretty big events that happened regarding abortion this week. Well, Texas actually is on the verge next week of changing what you do with aborted fetuses. It used to be that, at least in that state and probably most places, what they do is they dump the fetuses in landfills along with all the other medical waste. And now, starting on December 19th, healthcare facilities will have to either cremate or bury the aborted fetuses. So if you're doing that, if you're treating it just like you would any other human life, people are going to have to acknowledge that it is a human life that is being dealt with. You can't just dump it into a pile of medical waste.
Isn't it amazing we even have to talk about some of these things? You know, most people probably, this is sort of one of those things. It's almost like a movie. Like, it happens in some other universe, but these things actually happen in this country every day, you know? And then people wonder why there's other problems. I don't know. Look at history. When people treat each other and their children this way, what have the results been?
Well, here's another one for you. This one's pretty crazy as well, and it actually involves our state right here. The Oklahoma Supreme Court just this Tuesday struck down a law from our state governor back in 2014, and all her law said was that, okay, abortion clinics have to at least meet the health standards of any other hospital or medical clinic. They struck down that law. So basically, what is that saying? We pro-choice advocates always say that the woman's health is so important, but if you're going into a relative cesspool to have this operation done, that just goes to show you that they don't care about the women's body, and really it's just all for profit, because probably close to half of women might think that an abortion is okay. Not everyone breaks their leg, you know, not everyone has other procedures, but a good amount of people at some point will make the choice whether or not to have an abortion. So they're just trying to get people in and out as fast as possible without regarding the health of the women. Out of 227 abortion clinics in 32 states, were cited for more than 1,400 health violations. So these are really disgusting places. We had a write-up on the Trumpet about that one in Philadelphia where it was just trash.
Yeah, that's what came to mind when you were mentioning that. And those don't really make the news, you know. And I think probably I've mentioned this before, at least I don't know if on the air, but when I was in high school, I mean, in health class, we had to look at a presentation. I think it was slides back then of what that actually looks like to have some of those procedures. That'll stick with you.
They don't do that at the abortion clinics now.
It'll make you think twice.
Right.
It's horrifying.
Yeah, I remember when I was 8. Driving through Nova Scotia when I lived there, there were anti-abortion activists there, and they had pictures of aborted fetuses to protest, and I was like, well, what's that? And I asked my parents, and they told me about it. And that was my first introduction to that, and that image of that they had in those posters have stuck with me to this day on what happens.
Yeah, and it's horrible, but, you know, it's, at least it gives you a real depiction of what's happening. They make it seem like it's all and no big deal. But it is a big deal. It's all the time we have for today. Some interesting topics. And thank you for spending some time with us here on Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and Trumpet Hour program today. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondo. Have a great rest of your day. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.